You've been writing like the underdog about to blossom into something great, like the best of the X-Men. So you can't just leave your own story. You'll be back. You have to be back. And you'll have a lot of reading to catch up on.
Chapter 23. The Cane. Dear Mr. Paolo, I am pleased you still write to my son. It has come to my attention that he no longer sends replies. He can read without my help now. I felt it would be invading his privacy to read the letters you have written to him. In the years that he has been under my guardianship, I have always tried to respect his privacy. He has not always had any privacy to respect. Because of this, it was only last week that I became aware that all the letters he has written to you remain stacked on his desk in a neat pile, sealed and stamped, but never sent. I was sorry to learn that he has not sent them, because I had hoped you remained his last source of solace. Watching his recent decline was bearable when I thought you were counteracting it. Now that I know that is not the case, I feel I must contact you and tell you about Moritz's behavior. Something has happened to my son, and it is something he will not speak to me about. We have always been quiet, but this silence is different. I once looked forward to clocking out of the factory to enjoy a few hours' time with him in the evenings. Now, when I return from work, our home is awash in a melancholy that is difficult to bear. I have a hard time crossing the doorway. The lights seem to flicker. The furniture looks older even than it is. If I approach Moritz's bedroom at the end of the hallway, the gloom in the air feels so heavy that my eyes water. Moritz rarely leaves his room. He has stopped going to school. He does not bathe and does not sleep. I can hear him clicking his tongue even in the early hours of the morning. There is a history of mental illness in his family, but Moritz will allow no medical professional near him, apart from the doctor who monitors his heart. I considered forcing him to see another, but after all he has endured, that seemed too cruel. I cannot commit that act of betrayal. This began months ago. Moritz went out with friends in the late afternoon, and when I came home after the late shift, the gloom had moved in with us. His friends, the girl in boots and the mute boy, have not stopped by to check on him, although Maxine Pruitt, his librarian, has come by. She was adamant about seeing him and pounded on his bedroom door for 20 minutes straight. He did not answer. After such a long time, even she seemed to succumb to the gloom emanating from his room. He must have heard her. We could hear him clicking. He does not stop now. She pushed school transfer documents under his door and left twice as angry as when she arrived. In the early morning or late in the night, he cracks open his door. Sometimes I can feel him passing in the hallway, and it wakes me from sleep as if a nightmare has slipped by. I recall reading your dolphin wave theory of Moritz's emotional transference. I try to join him in the kitchen when he goes on these excursions. He eats in silence and mostly only uncooked oatmeal. I make coffee that he does not drink, and I sit across from him at the table and try to find words to say, but we have never communicated much in this way. He does not wear his goggles. His hair is greasy enough that it looks as though he has been standing in the rain. His breathing is often stilted. I have been careful to check his pacemaker every time he appears, and he does not protest. So at least he is not wishing for death yet. But he will not talk to me. He clicks. Sometimes he writes to you at the kitchen table, by hand now, which would make me proud in other circumstances. I ask him what's wrong, and he shakes his head. He will not face me. Of course he does not have to, but he once chose to. I ask him how he is, and he shakes his head. I ask him how you are, and he leaves the table. At first I thought he was angry with you, but then I read his movements more carefully. The way his ears redden, his lips curl down. It is not anger that has silenced him. It is shame. Or fear. I do not know what he is afraid of. Afraid you will reject him? He underestimates you. He will never again be a trusting boy after all he has experienced. But his past is not mine to tell you. Forgive me for breaching your privacy and invading your correspondence, but as the closest thing to his father, I cannot remain silent any longer. This evening I asked him to bathe, and at last he complied. While he was in the bathroom, I broke into his desk drawer and read your letters. I plucked the oldest envelope from his stack, and on my way to work, I will place it in an envelope alongside this note and send it to you. I will take a deep breath before I enter the apartment this evening. He will notice the letter's absence. I do not doubt the gloom will deepen. I do not want you waiting and wondering if he has become lost in a wardrobe. His narrative continues. My son is only as flawed as any human being, but he is unwilling to accept himself. I know you are willing to accept him. When I met him long ago, I saw myself. Before I met him, I was also always alone. Moritz and I have an understanding. I understand his silence, and he understands mine. But you are the first person Moritz has truly communicated with. You are the first step into society that he has ever willingly taken, and I am so proud of his progress. I am grateful for your devotion. He is as well, which is perhaps why he finds it so difficult to contact you now. I beg you, do not dismiss him. Do not wait for him to explain himself. We have not seen all that he has seen. Words are not easy for all of us. Gerhard Farber. Oliver, I don't know what I should do. You're telling me your story, and I can do no more than skim the contents of your letters. I cannot begin to process your words except to say, what happened to Joe was a tragedy. In no way was it of your making. Now I am the one who cannot focus. Forgive me, I don't know what to do. I am considering going to the hospital. Not for myself, but I am alone in my kitchen again. I am frightened. I do not know whether I should turn myself in to the authorities or say nothing. I don't know what to do. It is my fault that Lenz Munk is hospitalized. I cannot hide this. It must be written all over my face. All over my soulless eye sockets. We made a great game of it. Typically during the hours spent after school in the sickly poet, we'd order drinks and plot Lenz's unfortunate demise. We had a list of ludicrous schemes that read like Edward Gorey's stories about dead children. A is for arsenic in Lenz's soup. B is for burning him down to his shoes. C is for cutting his heart from his chest. D is for drowning him down with the squids. And so on. We joked about performing it at the microphone. We were only joking. I did not intend to kill him. Only to frighten him. To discourage him from targeting the tongueless and eyeless again. But Fika wanted more. She dragged on her long cigarettes, swore under her breath that he had it coming. Her heart rate increased. She seemed almost thrilled, instilled with a fiery drive for violence. I should have shied away, Ollie. I have seen scientists look like that. We resolved that the best way to confront him would be to lure him into instigating a fight. If someone witnessed the attack, it would seem he had started the altercation. We waited for him after school today, under the bridge where he'd fed Owen a fuzz sandwich. First, we met at Owen's dingy apartment. Owen and Fika live alone. Fika is old enough to be a legal guardian. Before that, they lived in orphanages. They don't speak about the past any more than I do. I do not needle. Ostzich is unapologetically rough. Their apartment, huddled away in the basement of a brick building, makes the one I share with Father seem glamorous by comparison. They did not invite me inside. They asked me to wait on the sidewalk. Fika led the way from the pavement to old winding cobbles that curled away beneath Zootbrücke, a pedestrian bridge across the stinking canal. I tried to squeeze Owen's hand once as we approached. My heart beat harder when he withdrew and tucked his hands away beneath his arms. He was still angry with me for last night. Do not ask about it now, Oliver. Fika and I hid in an alcove between two concrete support beams. Owen stood alone in the center of the pavement, far too exposed for my liking. The wind picked up. The sour smell of cold canal water pricked my nostrils. There was another scent as well. Pumpernickel. "He's coming," I said. Sure enough, moments later, that signature slip-scrape of Monk's uneven gait led to his appearance before us. He was walking with his head down, looking at the cobbles, until he nearly trod on Owen.
"What do you want?"
he grunted. Owen blinked. There was something the matter with all of this. The look on Fika's face was that unpleasant smile. I could almost hear it. So creaking, so forced. And Lens. He looked angry, yes, but also troubled. I didn't have time to consider this. Fika pushed me out into the fray. Lens jerked back, showed his teeth. "Listen," I pointed my cane at him. "You've had your fun. Never again."
"Leave me alone,"
said Lens, scowling. He tried to push past both of us, leaving me with my mouth agape. Fika stepped into his path with her arms folded over her chest.
"Away, Fika."
He pushed right past her, much like he'd tried to push me in the gym. But she didn't dodge it. She bared her teeth and took his palm against her sternum. She made no effort to catch herself. When she fell, Owen pounced. I had thought he was meek like a lamb, but he leapt right onto Lens's back and threw his arms around his throat, nails out like a lion.
"Moritz, you idiot! Get him!"
But Lens Monk grabbed Owen by the head, pulled him over his shoulder to throw him against the cobbles. Owen landed on his back and cried out, a squawking cry that cut me to the core. Because the moment Owen cried out in pain and coughed air from his lungs, my heart rate increased and my pacemaker strained, and I saw every scratch that had ever been made in the stones underfoot, every strand of hair in between them, the insects colonizing underneath the rocks, the fungi growing on the underside of the bridge, and the minuscule portions of phlegm expelled with Owen's exhaled lungful of breath, and the tiny particles of flour in Lens's hair, and the way his eyes were crinkled with rage and hurt. Because I heard all this, I moved before the second was out. Before I knew it, I had done it. I had done it. MBV allowed me to aim the butt end of my cane directly into the softest pressure point in his throat, and stab with as much effort as I could muster. with all the precision of a surgeon installing a pacemaker, with all the talent of an artist with a brush or a seamstress with a needle. It took precisely one sharp thrust and then two hands shoved against his diaphragm to undo him. Lentz didn't even raise a hand to me. He gasped for air, clutching at his throat, tripped backward over Owen's supine form. When he fell, he smacked his head against the pavement. Crack! And in the echoes, his head was swelling, and in his wheezes, I saw he was not rising again. What monster am I, Ollie? I took three steps backward. I could not escape this.
Got him!
Fika's eyes shone with inhuman rage, similar to my own fury moments before. She climbed to her feet, dusted off her knees, relit her cigarette before helping Owen up. He was wheezing, but smiling. That frightened squawking, that cry that called me to action, was it a performance? Did I transfer my rage to them? Was this what I did to normal people? Or was this rage all their own? I did not know. I could not spare the time to care. I could hear Lentz's pulse, but he had hit his head hard. He burbled. In his burbles I heard again how monstrous I am. I heard my nothingness. Lentz was sprawled across the cobbles and bleeding between us. But both Owen wheezing and Fika scowling stared at me. They were not the ones who'd wrecked him.
Why are you looking like that? He had this coming. See if he fluffs with us again. Wait and see.
Call an ambulance.
Are you kidding?
She said. Owen shook his head. He was still coughing. I did not feel sorry for him. Your phone. Give it to me. He hit his head.
Hell no!
Perhaps she was in shock. Perhaps I should have commiserated, should have realized she could not be as cruel as she seemed. I stepped forward, cold and clicking. Fika took half a step back. I grabbed her. I could see precisely how she was going to move. Suddenly she looked alien to me. A terrified little girl who thought I might hit her. But I only took the phone from her pocket and turned away. She replaced her mask of rage. But I had seen that little girl, and she was well aware. So she spat out with more bile than before.
Coward! Just duck your head again, all right? Just leave!
I did not reply. I called emergency services. I hope he is not dead. I hope he has been hospitalized, not placed under a coroner's care. I left the scene of the crime. What have I become? My mother's monstrous experiment, and I can't pretend to be anything else. I can't hide behind goggles or masks. Oliver, should I go see him? You would. Certainly you would. You ran directly at that power line. I stepped outside the apartment door and into the mildew-ridden hallway. I dropped my keys onto the concrete and clutched my chest and edged back inside once more. I edged all the way backward down the hall and into my bedroom and shut myself away inside. I cannot do it. If Lentz were the only one, perhaps I could go, but there are others. Others all over the world who have suffered for my sake.
I can't tell whether it is my heart disease or something else that makes my ribs ache now. But I am not so brave as you, Ollie. How can I face you again? How can I face any soul on earth with all that I have seen and been? I am no one's hero, Moritz.
Chapter 24. The Music. Dear Mr. Farber, thank you for writing. I'm glad that Moritz isn't stuck in a parallel dimension or something, and annoyed he doesn't have that kind of excuse for not answering me. I mean, at least if he were trapped in a parallel world, he could say like, "Oh, my deepest apologies, sir. The boggiest of swamp extraterrestrials is gnawing upon my foot, while I tap inane rap music into his skull. I cannot afford to write you. I must fend him off my beloved toes. Let him rot." Or something. Man, I miss him. Please tell him that I can't wait to hear from him again. For now, I'll try writing knowing he's on the other end. I'm relieved to know he might be there pretty soon. Please make sure he gets this letter. Even if he doesn't write back, I don't know how to think anymore if I don't write all my thoughts down for him. Oliver. Mr. Farber, stop reading this now. Just testing. I guess it doesn't matter, really. Moritz. Don't talk like that. You aren't a monster. You were scared and your friend was hurt, and fick me for telling you to be heroic. I don't think you meant to hurt him like that. It's like you lost control, and that's something I understand pretty well. And maybe I'm terrible, because all I feel right now is relieved. No matter how terrible a situation you're in, you're alive. So maybe you're not a hero, but you're not a villain either. You couldn't leave him bleeding when he's left you bleeding more than once. I don't care if you came from a petri dish or Frankenstein's table. I don't care where you came from anymore, because it's enough that you exist and you keep trying, Moritz. That's the most human thing. Let me say what you said to me. Get out of bed. Stand up. I hope you can find the motivation to see Lentz. I wish I could go see Joe. Then again, I'm grateful I have an excuse not to. I don't have excuses for everything. Sometimes I really screw up. The party was a disaster, and I wish it didn't matter. Relieved as I am to know you're somewhere, I wish you were here, Mo. On the day of the party, I sat on the porch and stared down the driveway, twiddling my fingers and wiping sweat from my forehead and standing up and sitting down again while Mom watched me, sipping a mug of warm cider. I was wearing a hand-sewn Zombie of Roderick Usher getup, all coated in red food coloring and dirt with painted circles under my eyes, and she was dressed as an undead version of Miss Havisham. She'd agreed to act the part after I joked that she was always single anyhow, so why the hell not take advantage of it? Miss Havisham is this old woman from Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. She got left at the altar on her wedding day and stopped all the clocks in her house and never changed out of her wedding gown, even when she turned into a scary old dinosaur. Maybe she looked the part too much. When she came out of her bedroom, having exchanged her wig for a tattered bridal veil and dress, looking like a jilted widow after all, I almost asked her to change. The party was supposed to start at noon. It was already 1 p.m., and the long brown line of the driveway stretched before us, vanishing into trees rustling in the wind, and not a soul had come down it. By 2 p.m., I could have sworn the driveway was more obscured by overgrown bushes than ever. I was craning my neck to see, and I thought there were suddenly more trees, like maybe they were growing on the driveway, and maybe people were coming down the driveway, seeing the trees, and turning back because our cabin doesn't really exist. "You're pulling your hair, Oliver," said Mom. "They won't come, will they? Not like it matters. It isn't a big deal. But they aren't coming." "Calm down. You're making me wish I were a zombie." "What, dead?" "Just brain dead. So I couldn't feel anxious. Sit down." I tried to sit back in the rocking chair and managed it for maybe 4 seconds before I heard a branch snap or an animal rustle in the woods, and I was up again, leaning on the railing.
"Maybe we should wait inside.
You used to be the one who couldn't sit still. No sense wasting energy, Mom said, easing her way to her feet. What, because they aren't coming and you knew they wouldn't and I shouldn't have bothered with this at all? Because who would want to come out here anyway? She put her hand on my shoulder. No, Ollie. Because I'm tired. I still haven't asked her about the fence, you know. At first, it was because what happened to Joe was just so much bigger than that electric fence I hadn't known about. Later, I didn't ask, because I was scared she would lie to me, or lock me inside the house for good this time. But now seemed like an opportunity, like my chance to ask her why she'd never sent me to school in a hazmat suit, why she'd never let me roll around in a bubble or something, why she wouldn't talk about Dad. Things that used to seem important. But I saw the lines in her face, her red eyes. She was just as sorry as I was that no one was going to come to my stupid party. You should go take a nap, Mom. She settled back into her chair. In a bit. 3 o'clock came and went, and none of them showed up. I slumped in my seat. At 4, I rubbed my palms together and Mom caved. This Havisham's restarting the clocks, Ollie. Maybe we've got the wrong day. Never mind. I'll go make you some hot chocolate. I'm not 5, Mom. Chocolate won't make me forget all my woes. I know. I've been eating it for years. But happy birthday. She pushed cobwebs away when she lifted her dead bride's veil to peck me on the forehead. After she left, I put my hands over my eyes. Of course they wouldn't want to come. Who was I kidding? It began to rain. I didn't consider puddle hopping. The driveway was longer than ever, and I couldn't stand looking at it anymore, so I went inside the haunted cabin to wait out the storm. Mom stayed with me as afternoon became evening. She was overdoing it. I scowled when she came into my bedroom. I snapped anthologies closed and glared at her. Or I continued carving or folding origami until she left, as if she had no more presence in my room than any of the origami litter. All the same, every 7 minutes she was in the doorway again. I finally pushed the telescope against the pinewood door until it jammed shut. Oliver, it's dinner. Sandwiches, not tuna. I heard her set the plate down, but she was still standing there. 30 minutes later, her knocking became frenzied.
Damn it! You're scaring me! Just open up!
The door rattled.
Do I have to call Auburn Stash?
Just leave me alone, I said. Go do something else.
Do what else?
She shouted, and her voice broke like it never had before. Mom? No reply. I don't know how she came to be here, what exactly happened to Dad, and whether she was guilty of bringing this on herself. Maybe she wanted to start a rock band. Maybe she wanted to study astrophysics. I didn't know what she used to do on rainy days, what she used to dream about, who her friends had been. I didn't know. I'd had one shitty day where no friends came to visit. She'd had a decade and a half. Maybe she didn't lock herself in the garage because I left her alone with a rotting brain. Maybe she really did lock herself in there to get away from me. Mom! I knocked the telescope away and opened the door. She was on her knees on the floor. Tears streaked down her cheeks under her Havisham veil, and her shoulders shook when I held her.
I'm sorry. Aren't we both the sorriest ever? If your father could see us now.
I rested my head on her shoulder.
Why don't you ever talk about him? Really, Mom? Needling.
She took a deep breath and exhaled into my hair.
You've always loved mysteries, Oliver.
Yeah, but
as long as there are mysteries to solve here, you'll have a reason to stay.
You had to hand it to her. The largest, most impenetrable lock in our house. And I'd never even seen it before. Liz showed up alone after dark. I had gone back outside after Mom went to bed. I was sitting on the porch without a coat on, even though it was damn cold. I was fuming, so I didn't really feel it. She seemed hesitant in her raincoat as she wheeled up on her bike, nothing like how she used to be. Maybe she could see the black taffeta we'd hung in the windows, the spiders dangling from the banisters, the streamers, and the bats. Maybe she could see me sitting there. She certainly saw me when I stood up.
"Ollie,"
she said, hiking her backpack up onto her shoulder.
"Hey, happy birthday. Sorry I'm so late.
Driver's Ed." I wanted to say something, but I really couldn't. When she stood beside me on the porch, I tried to meet her eyes.
"Can I come in?"
I just walked inside. She could follow if she wanted, I supposed. I wasn't going to tackle her to the ground or anything. When we reached the living room, she screeched. One of the dangling plastic centipedes we'd hung from the ceiling had slapped against her face.
"What the hell?"
I watched her eyes widen by candlelight as she scanned the room. My anatomical skeleton looked horrific in the light of lanterns covered in green and blue film, jutting from a cardboard coffin, organs pulled out and draping down to the floor. Cobwebs coated every bookshelf and table. I was heading for my room, but Liz stopped as we passed through the kitchen to the dining room. We'd decked out this part of the cabin in a Poe and Dickens crossover party. The dinner table was laden with lace and a half-dilapidated cake Mom had spent hours stacking up just so we could smack it with a mallet, giggling like sadistic ghouls. There was a swinging foam pendulum in the entranceway, and we'd lifted some of the floorboards to shove a papier-mâché heart underneath, although, of course, it had no telltale beating.
"Wow, Ollie, you went all out."
We'd spent so much time trying to make the table look as though it hadn't been touched in decades, and now it would never be touched after all. I walked up the stairs without a word. She followed me past black lace curtains into the chaos of my bedroom. I sat on the bed. I didn't bother moving the canvases and comics.
"I have a present for you."
She held out a pink package. When I didn't take it, she set it on my cluttered desk.
"So say something, please."
So everyone had driver's training, right? I had never seen her so uncertain. She was wearing a lot of makeup, biting her lip.
"I didn't invite anyone. I didn't even tell anyone."
She sat down beside me, laying her bag at her feet. It was glowing softly. She couldn't come over without her phone anymore.
"But your decorations are really something. You know, there's going to be a Halloween dance in a couple weeks at school. And it won't look half as amazing as this. Your costume's great, too."
"Yeah, zombies are easier to pull off when you're me," I said. "So you can just come here instead, hey. We can leave the decorations up for a few weeks, no biggie." Liz sighed.
"I'm going to the dance with Martin Mulligan. Because I know who that is."
My blood rang in my ears. This was it. She was finally done with the hopeless hermit.
"He's a senior. He's going to study computer engineering at State. You'd like him. He's really nice. Smart, like you."
"I don't think I would like him, although I might like kicking him between the legs." First, she was angry. Then she put her hand on mine.
"If things were different,
if I were anyone else," I said, trying to grin. "I can never listen to electronica. I can never study engineering."
"It's not that. After all this time, you think, Ollie, it's not the fact that you're trapped in the woods. It's that you're trapped in yourself."
I stood up. My face felt numb, not because of electricity, because of other charges in the air between us, because I wanted to repel the truth of what she was saying. "What is that supposed to mean?
Tell me, Ollie, how many siblings have I got?
What's my favorite subject?
You, or my favorite color, even? My favorite food?
You never talk about those things. Or what she does on rainy days?" Something twisted in my stomach.
"You never ask about them, Ollie. You don't care about anything that goes on that you're not a part of. It's like you think the rest of the world doesn't matter."
"That's not true. I care about other people. I care about Moritz." She threw her hands up in the air.
"You mean the pen pal you never have to meet? The one you'll never have to deal with in person? The one who's only ever going to exist inside your head?"
"Shut up.
Tell me, Ollie, when's my birthday? I didn't know the answer, Moritz. I closed my mouth. After a moment, Liz got up to go to the bathroom. Her tears were messing up all that mascara. I had to do something. I was losing her. I was losing everything. She'd left her backpack on the floor. It didn't take a lot of digging to find what I was looking for. It was one of the things that people seemed to superglue to themselves, a little square of metal with earbuds dangling from it. I put the earbuds in my ears. My fingers hovered over the triangular button. When I heard the toilet flush, I pressed it. A viridian, amorphous surge of electricity engulfed me. When Liz came back, she knew something was wrong. She was probably tipped off by the bulging of my eyes or the way my head kept thrusting itself back and forth against the headboard. Ollie! New wave! I tried to smile, but my face went slack. Liquid slipped from my bottom lip. More than saliva, because I'd bitten my tongue burning red. Her eyes widened. She tried to pull the player from me, but my fingers tightened around it. That wasn't the oncoming seizure doing that, I swear. I couldn't tell her that the sounds from the buds were so different from anything I'd ever felt that I would have died to hear more. There were poundings, bass, and something that must have been a synthesizer punching my eardrums. If it hadn't been her face, her eyes imploring me to stop, I never would have let go. When she yanked the earbuds from my ears, there was blood on them. She kept clawing at my hands. I unclenched my fingers. Hot blood spewed from my nose as she threw the machine out my window into the rain. But it still felt like I was holding it, like its vibrations were shaking my brain against my skull. I was trying my hardest not to let the tremors win, but when a seizure takes you, you're powerless. Mom told me that she came in right then, right when I lost consciousness and started convulsing outright. It didn't take her long to understand what had happened. She told Liz to leave. Liz went. I wondered if all she had ever wanted was an excuse. Later, I opened the package, and inside was that stupid old book light again. Passing the torch, I guess. Or another goodbye. Hey, Moritz. Have I ever asked you when your birthday is? If being raised in a laboratory made you a monster, what did being raised in the middle of nowhere make me? I wish it would stop raining already. But that's selfish, too. Ollie.
Chapter 25. The Rose-Colored Spectacles. Do not think that my silence has been because I blame you for the harrowing events relayed in your camping confessional letter. That letter left me gasping in sympathy. Hear me now. Hear me in all caps. It was never your fault. The guilt you feel is no more unusual than it is justified. I know how difficult it is not to feel responsible for terrible things that happen when you are helpless to change them. My birthday falls on July 3rd. Can you believe I'm a summer child? Ollie, you have given me all the kindness I never deserved. If that is selfishness, then I do not know the meaning of the word. I did not mean to abandon you like this, sad and alone in the wake of both my neglect and Liz's. But I am so lost. I have been feeling very low for what felt like an eternity. Doubtless, Father told you. I wanted to hurt him. When I realized he had forwarded my letter to you without my consent. But his face, it was on the verge of dissolution. I can't hurt him. He saved me once, twice. I haven't told you, but the man I call Father saved me. I do not know what has become of Lenz Monk. I have not left the apartment. I dare not tell Father what happened. I cannot face his disappointment. It has taken me so long to tell even you. Your confessions shed light on my own experiences, and now I tremble at my desk. Your honesty about your suffering, your confounded honesty,
has at last given me cause to share my own trials with you. Long before the disaster with Lens, other memories made me monstrous. I began writing down my beginnings some time ago. Here's a concept you might not have read about. Vergangenheitsbewältigung. The word roughly translates to working through the past. This is difficult to describe to you. You are not German, but the people of Germany, as you have hinted before, do have a dark history behind them. We are haunted. On a personal level, I am also haunted. All of us may have darkness in our past, Oliver. Some of us are haunted by those who came before us. I said I would not speak of this. I tried to see the laboratory as you imagine it, a factory that produces dolphin-wavy superheroes in bright colors. Perhaps a workshop full of vials and potions, where men are given adamantium skeletons, where the dead return to life. But this is not science fiction, Ollie. In the hopes that it will strengthen the friendship that has grown between us, in fear that it is just as likely to rend us asunder, I want to tell you of my mother and the initiative she founded. I want to tell you about the children she worked with. The children like us. I won't apologize for withholding. Despite your disdain, I want to spare your ears whenever possible. I did not consider myself bound by linearity. Whenever you spoke of your mother, I recalled my own mother in vivid bursts that all but left me gasping. Your mother's electric fences and locks, smothering as they seem to you, are better than what raised me. There is no pacemaker for this manner of heartache. Like my mother before me, I am a weak-hearted fool. The name of my cardiovascular disease is cardiomyopathy. My brand of this disease is hypertrophic. My heart is weak, anatomy expert. This is due to an inexplicable thickening of the arteries within the cardiac muscle. This thickening restrains my blood flow, chokes my heart out from the left ventricle. This disease is often passed down in families, the heaviest inheritance. My mother knew to look for it, even when I was a fetus. Not because she was a renowned doctor, which she was, but because a swollen heart claimed her sister. It stole her cousin and a distant uncle. It is this disease that leaves me frequently breathless, that swells my legs into tree trunks and makes my heart beat rhythmless. It is this disease that has often claimed young people at unawares, during sports matches or at nightclubs or in the moments when they are most excited, when their hearts fail to keep up with their hopes. Did you wonder why I am such a pessimist? It is this illness that my mother passed down to me. This illness that she once spent every spare moment of her life working to cure. When she founded the laboratory that made me how I am, Oliver, she did so with good intentions. To study and amend cardiomyopathy and other genetic conditions in utero, to spare infants lives of inherited pain, pains as small as colorblindness, as large as sickle cell anemia. Vergangenheitsbewältigung, correcting a broken past for the sake of the future. When most people reminisce about dear ones lost, they see those dear ones through rose-colored spectacles. I'm not sentimental. I see my mother as she was. There is something deflated about her appearance. She could put on the nicest patent leather shoes and a skirt and a silk blouse beneath her lab coat and just seem to sag inside them. Her eyes were ringed by circles a corpse would envy. She smiled rarely, and even then a misalignment of her jaw that made her top and bottom gums level ensured that her smiles were inevitably sharkish,
displaying all her teeth at once. Perhaps this was fitting. Her smiles were calculated. Of course, I loved her. Does a child consider anything else? I did not consider how she never looked at me. She fed me and clothed me and raised me. That was love. My mother never spoke of my father. She acted as though he had never existed, implied that he was no more tangible than an anonymous donor. He mattered no more than a strand of DNA in a vial. Perhaps she was more human before he left her. Perhaps not. I have no way of knowing. I wouldn't have known he was a man of flesh and blood at all, except that in my youth I overheard my nanny saying over the phone that a good-for-nothing had left my mother alone with a retard in her belly. Some things you forget as a child. Some things you do not. My mother studied medicine in Berlin before she ever worked at the laboratory. Yes, Ollie, a laboratory. The laboratory. However fantastical your hypothesis, you're a good detective. Soon you might wish, more than ever, that you were wrong. Doubtless this was the same laboratory that your father spent time in. I imagine your father was a kind man, just as many of my doctors were. Most of the doctors who began working at the initiative had noble intentions, Oliver. They wanted to fix us before we even existed. They manipulated fetal DNA. They spotted diseases in amniotic fluid and endeavored to undo them. They plucked and pulled at genes to defy kidney disease, to purge Tay Sachs from the womb, to deter fragile X chromosomes, to take hardships from the very beginnings of people. Sometimes epilepsy is genetic, isn't it, Oliver? In the beginning, they meant well. I don't know when this changed, but it did. By the time I was toddling, the scientists were no longer seeking cures to diseases. They were seeking evolution. They were seeking dangerous frontiers. Science for the sake of science is a terrifying thing, Ollie. I know this in my weak heart, in my gut. I know this because this laboratory was my second home. The people working there were my family. The laboratory is here in Saxony, likely within 100 kilometers of Kreisig. In the workday hours, my mother worked at a clinic in Kreisig, treating colds and fevers, fungal growths and eczema. I remained at home with that cold-natured nanny. My mother did not want me coddled. On the weekends, we traveled to the laboratory, where she served as the medical and experimental director. To my memory, she was the highest authority in the facility, the founder of what seemed to be an international initiative. Every weekend, she strapped me into my car seat, hushed me with a finger to halt my clicking. Then she pulled out into the streets and away from the city. I slept in the car and we traveled. Already, transportation made me uncomfortable. I remember the roads were winding, but I could not see them. I could not have been very far from where we lived. We always arrived within an hour or so. We parked in an underground garage that led directly into the facility. You would not believe the ordinariness of the secret laboratory you are so curious about, Ollie. It seemed no different from any wing of any given hospital. It smelled like antiseptic, sweetened by a latexy odor that dried out the nostrils. There was always a receptionist sitting at a counter by the entrance. Magazines littered the tables, clipboards in slots on the walls, wheelchairs beside the automatic doors. Several waiting rooms were spread across two floors and a basement level, although there were no windows. The laboratory was fully staffed with scientists, doctors and nurses and maintenance men and women from every continent. More than this, though, there were patients. The patients were children. Perhaps they had originally been diseased. Now they were experiments. You would not believe how far the laboratory had strayed. The scientists' nightmarish curiosity had resulted in nightmarish results. Unbelievable results, even. I question my memories. Could the children have been as bizarre as I recall? Or have my Albtrauma, my bad dreams, merged with reality? Regardless, the other children in the laboratory were not superheroes any more than I am. I remember a girl with curly hair. Either I am delusional, or she had a second mouth on the back of her head that she had to feed on a constant basis. Very often she sat holding a Slurpee cup in her hand with a long, twisting straw winding over her shoulder to satiate that maw. At nighttime she strapped a pacifier to the back of her head. Could I have dreamed her up? And even she was not the strangest. There was a pale, hairless boy whose arms and legs were jointed the wrong way. He could turn his head around almost 190 degrees, and always did so whenever I passed by. What possible noble intention could have resulted in that? I have memories, real or no, of dozen-fingered toddlers and a lipless boy who disgorged his esophagus, a parasitic-looking tube lined with two rows of tiny teeth, whenever he wanted to eat. Once I witnessed him devour beef stew in the laboratory cafeteria. The sight of him sucking up chunks of beef was unappetizing. It looked as if a worm had burst from his throat to sip sewage. Maybe their ailments were more typical than I recall. Time has warped my recollections. I never spoke to these other children. My mother carried me everywhere when I was small, perhaps just so I would not speak to them. She would spare a few minutes to tote me around the halls and observation rooms of the complex. I was a trophy. The scientists and doctors she worked with would fawn over me, prod me, perform casual clandestine experiments on the eyeless child. There was a man by the name of Dr. Rochnebart who took interest not only in my oddities, but in my well-being also. He would stop us in the hallway every time I arrived. "Peekaboo," he'd say, but cover one of my ears rather than his eyes. He'd use his other hand to hold up a number of fingers, wait for me to match his number with my own. Sometimes my mother would accompany him to rooms full of scanners, my weekly physical. She was always distracted, always looking away whenever anyone addressed her. I could hear how her stuttering heartbeat matched my own. I could hear it. Even as a toddler, it upset me. Rochnebart and the other scientists became disgruntled. Her proximity disrupted their results. So she would leave me there alone and attend to work elsewhere. She never told me what she was doing. She put her hand on my chest some evenings after work, and then her other hand on her own. Looked at me as properly as she ever would, eyes on my chest, if not on my face. I believed then that her work was for my sake, for the sake of our weak hearts. We did not often speak in my family, Ollie. We were never like you. I harbor scattered memories of my experiences in the laboratory. Every few months men in suits toured the facility. The doctors were always a flutter in these weeks, dressing us nicely, washing our faces, presenting the best sides of us, demanding that we smile and wave at visitors from all around the globe. I smiled the brightest. Imagine that, Ollie. I felt privileged to be there, even as a kindergartner. The scientists were always kind when they sat me down with nodes attached to my scalp and asked me to listen to recordings. When they muffled or plugged my ears and asked me to describe objects on the other side of the room. They claimed other children would envy the microchip behind my left ear.
You're like an android. So cool.
Several scientists were native English speakers. That was where I attained English fluency at an early age. Every test was presented as a game. I remember playing sports that mostly involved smiling men and women in lab coats throwing various projectiles at me to measure the extent of my reflexes. They cheered when I caught every object they threw at me. Cheered and scribbled on notepads and typed my success into computers. High fives and applause. I was so proud, so beloved. And a few of the other children, some of whom never left the facility, took notice. When I was 8, Rochnerbart sent me to a vending machine with a fistful of coins after my exceptional work during a game that involved dunking me into a water tank to see how my vision fluctuated underwater. I stood in the hallway, dripping onto the linoleum, shivering in my bathing suit, quietly pleased, torn between potato crisps and a chocolate bar. My MBV was alerted to motion behind me. I angled my left ear toward the disturbance. "May I help you?" politely, as I'd been taught. The girl with two mouths stood behind me, arms pressed against the sides of her dress. "Hello, Prince Moritz." She popped gum between the teeth in the back of her skull. "Why don't you ever look at anyone?"
"Beg pardon, I am always looking."
Rochnerbart was teaching me proper manners and social mannerisms. I reminded myself to face her when I spoke to her. I turned around.
"Why don't you ever talk to any of us, Prince Moritz? Even in the cafeteria?"
"Why are you calling me Prince?" She didn't answer, but smiled wide. That chewing sound was wearing. I kept seeing the curls of her hair and the creases in the malformed lips in sharp relief, whether or not I wished to.
"Well, I should be going back. They're waiting for me."
"They're always waiting for you,"
she giggled. Typically, I would have left her there, left her while she smiled beatifically. But my heart thumped with something like hope, Ollie.
Would you like to come with me? Perhaps you can go swimming too."
"Really?"
She closed her eyes and grinned all the wider. Those second teeth still chomped away at that gum.
"Oh, please. We don't get to do the things you do, Prince Moritz."
She took my hand, and I forgot to choose my snack. I showed her to the observation room that housed the water tank. A shaggy-haired janitor was mopping some of the splashed water from the floor. He looked up as we entered, but as usual, said nothing.
"What is she doing here, Moritz?"
said Dr. Merrill, peeking out from behind his laptop on the opposite side of the room. Merrill was relatively new to the staff. I did not know him well, but he was almost always grinning and bobbing his head in agreement, high-fiving me. He wore large glasses that gave him something of a clownish appearance that was enhanced by the way he flip-flopped along the tiles on over-large feet. He tended to cling to my mother, rattling off his ideas for chromosomal manipulation as a means for progressing humanity as a species. One of the zealots, Ollie. Of course, Mother hardly noticed him. She was always elsewhere in her head, studying something kilometers away. This was the first time I had ever seen Merrill frown.
"Moritz?"
"Well..."
My face grew hot.
"I don't know her name."
The girl laughed.
"It's Molly."
"I know who she is, Moritz. She belongs in the children's ward. She shouldn't be in here."
"I was hoping she could play in the pool with me," I mumbled.
"This isn't a playroom."
He gave us another sad clown frown.
"What would your mom say?"
Dr. Rochnerbart came in from the hand-washing room. He blinked at us. His face crinkled into a smile. Oh, let them have their fun. Merrill returned to his computer. Rochnerbart ducked away again while Molly and I approached.